Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes, and I'm delighted that you're with us today. You know, the single most important development in the second half of the 20th century, when it comes to our finally being able to understand the greater reality in which we live, the event that made it all possible was the publication in 1975 of a book called Life After Life. It was really only in the previous 15 years or so that technology had advanced to the point where people close to death were being resuscitated in hospitals in some numbers. And a young physician named Raymond Moody, I believe he was a resident at the time, he noticed that a few of these people who had been brought back from almost dying were talking about wonderful experiences they had while they were almost dead. He assembled some of their stories, and he coined the term near-death experiences, and then he published Life After Life. When I told you my story last week, I told you that I had been trying since I was 8 years old to understand my own experiences of light. I had figured out that these experiences had to have come from where the dead were, and I was trying to understand how I could figure out what that was like. But I wasn't having much luck. I was 29 years old, and I was pretty frustrated, and then Life After Life burst upon the world, and suddenly the floodgates of after-death information really opened. Mm-hmm. By the early 80s, there was a whole raft of books that were being published about the afterlife, and I was able at last to do some deep research. So I owe so much to Dr. Raymond Moody. What I had had was not a near-death experience. What I had had was actually a contact from my primary spirit guide. I know that now. But what Dr. Raymond Moody did, which was so amazing, was that he opened our minds to the fact that there's a whole lot more going on than we have ever imagined. And he did it in such a way that it was accessible to people. It was a very exciting time, late 70s, early 80s, and I owe a lot to Dr. Moody. In fact, I think we all do. Eventually, I did actually meet him. We shared dinner and conversation several years ago, so I got to tell him in person what a hero he was for me. Then in the spring of 2017, Seek Reality hosted Lisa Smart. Her final words project, very fascinating, had resulted in a wonderful book called Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And now both of these pioneers, we're hoping we'll hear from Dr. Moody, but Lisa's already with us. Both of these pioneers in the field of near death have teamed in a new project called the University of Heaven. And I'm excited they've chosen Seek Reality as one of the venues where they're breaking this wonderful news. Welcome to both of you. Let me know if you hear from Dr. Moody. We're hoping he'll call in. But Lisa is here.
He's here.
Yay! Consider yourself virtually
yes.
hugged.
I just beamed in from the Eastern. Yes.
I love it.
I heard the whole thing, so yes, I'm just happy to be here. Thank you so much for this opportunity, really.
I'm so glad you're here.
And thank you so much, too, for the kind words.
But the thing is, I really meant it. Until you broke the ice, the whole notion of understanding anything about what is really going on was just beyond anybody's pale. I mean, it was, frankly, as I said, I don't know if you heard me say, yours was the most important book of the second half.
Yeah, I did, and thank you so much.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that book.
In terms of the, and I am just so grateful to you that, you said those words about my work inspiring you. And maybe I should sort of, send that along and say that the person who inspired me in it was Plato.
Oh,
because, truly, I had I was not in a religious family because we were afraid of snakes. No, I'm just kidding. I made that last part up. We didn't, you know, religion was not our thing. And so I didn't, the idea of an afterlife, I never even thought that anybody took it seriously. But when I went to the University of Virginia at age 18, I majored in philosophy. My first book I read in my first few days of University of Virginia studying philosophy was Plato's Republic, which is about near-death experiences. Believe it or not, that's
really
what it culminates in this amazing. Plato talks about the different ways that the ancient Greeks thought that you could get to the other world, which they thought of, like we tend to think of up, right? Because of Plato actually was the person who put it up, you know, upwards. But before then, it was downwards in the underworld. And there was different kinds of journeys they thought that were the way they could get there. Well, there were different ways, the three ways, but the third way was they knew that sometimes people would almost die and be revived, and these early philosophers were very interested in this. See, this is, believe it or not, this is one of the foundations of Western way of thinking, is the Greek philosophers who studied these things. And Democritus, who lived about the same time as Plato, see, he's the one who sprouted the opposite explanation. See, Plato said, this really indicates an afterlife, but Democritus said, no, this is just the residual biological activity of the body. Like today, people say it's the oxygen deprivation, right?
Right.
So that was my inspiration. And then 3 years later in 1965, the other person who inspired me was the first living person I heard a near-death experience from. I only knew them before from the context of the early Greek reports, and I didn't realize it was anything to do with modern America. And so heard Dr. Ritchie's story, and then I got a PhD in philosophy. I started teaching at East Carolina University. Began to hear these from my students and my colleagues. And then went on, after 3 years of teaching philosophy, went to medical school and began to hear this from patients and so on. So thousands and thousands. And so my point was, thank you so much for saying that I was your inspiration, and I am grateful for that. And I just wanted to acknowledge that, you know, that the people who inspired me in this are the early philosophers who studied it, and also this wonderful, finest human being I ever knew, George Ritchie. He was just the greatest guy.
Yes.
He had an amazing, 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 wow, you know, visitation to not just one world, but several different realms of the afterlife, as he called it.
Well, what's great is that there is an extraordinary ether or many astral universes. People don't understand. Scientists know that the physical universe is less than 5% of what exists, but nobody's curious about what's in the rest. And so many people now have had personal experiences in that rest of reality. And it was Dr. Moody who got us started in talking and thinking about it. So let's talk about, how did you come up with the term near-death experiences? Obviously, it sprang to your mind.
I remember exactly where I was. I was on Laurel Street in Augusta, Georgia. I was a medical student, second year medical student. And I was just happily writing up I would do these interviews. I had them on tape and I would transcribe them. And I had been doing this for some years. And so in, let's see, it was sometime in 73, yeah, 73, and I was just sort of writing all this down, and my thought process was, you can't call them death experiences because these people weren't really dead, because by definition, they, you know, if they were revived, they weren't really dead.
Right.
But that nonetheless, they were near death, because you hear that phrase all the time, right? That so-and-so is near death in the hospital. I mean, it's just a vernacular term.
Yes.
So to me, I said near-death experiences because to indicate that it's the person was close to death in a way that wasn't too precisely defined, because it could occur in a lot of different medical circumstances, like a cardiac arrest or a severe infection or an incident of childbirth or and so that was my thinking. See, I'm happy that I got a PhD in philosophy and studied logic and analytic philosophy before I even went to medical school. So I wrote that book, you know, in such a way that it would cover all the obvious kind of difficulties and objections that people could raise. And because I made it so obvious that, you know, it's this question of proof of life after death. That's not easy. That is something that is maybe beyond our ken. But there are new ways to do it, and that is why that Lisa and I are so excited about the launching. And let me give the address, because I am really enthusiastic about this project. Our address is www.theuniversityofheaven.com. And what Lisa and I were thinking about is that this information, as you know, as we all know, is just very, very important. And and there is also a lot of kind of unreliable information about and lore and so on that is not very well grounded. So what we want to do is, the idea is to create a learning portal where we can have seminars on, webinars as they call them, on interviewing people who have had very profound near-death experiences. And primarily, for example, our first interviewee will be Dr. Eben Alexander, who is the Harvard neurosurgeon who had a profound near-death experience in 2008. And just some really wonderful physicians who've had these profound experiences. And so we're giving a free webinar to introduce us on October 30th, and it's easy to find. Like I said, the address is www.theuniversityofheaven.com. And so what we have, you know, we want to get, like, really reliable information and directly from people who've had astounding experiences. And then as we enlarge, we also have programs that are forthcoming on grief, which is a very common phenomenon. And I have been de facto a grief counselor, I guess, since around 1970, actually, or 71, when I first started lecturing on these near-death experiences. People would come to me and they would obviously be looking at these near-death experiences as giving them comfort in the wake of the loss. And I would not even gone to medical school at that time. And but I had my PhD in philosophy, and I knew some of the early Greek philosophers. See, what most of the early schools of philosophy wrote what they call consolation books, which were essentially little manuals to help people in grief over the loss of a loved one, and also to help them with their fear of dying. And so there was that tradition that I knew of, and so I tried my best, but it's been continuous ever since. So we're going to have a program on grieving and some of the things that take place in the grieving process, and Lisa and I are doing a book together. I've been working on this book for 10 years, and it's finally coming, and Lisa's helping me bring it together into this, and it's called God is Bigger Than the Bible, and it's going to be a basis of a course we're doing, and so all kinds of wonderful projects, so we just hope people will join us, and meanwhile, both of us very excited by our work in this is going to sound a bit counterintuitive, but in my study of my field in philosophy was I studied logic, and it also involved a field of philosophy called philosophy of language. And, you know, it is a much tougher problem than you might just imagine when you start thinking about it, to understand what it is to something to meaning. I mean, I know it sounds so completely abstract, but in reality, this connects in a very, very real way with the study of near-death experiences, because the most common thing that people tell us who've had a near-death experience, and I'm sure that you will agree with this from your own experience that you described earlier, is that people say, no matter how articulate they are, as you obviously are, by the way, that, or how many languages they speak or whatever, that they say they simply cannot describe it. They cannot put it into words. So you see, philosophy of language is really at the heart of how we can understand these experiences, because there aren't any words for them, and yet all we have of them are words.
What's interesting, in fact, is that in the afterlife, they don't use words. Very quickly, the natural way for them to speak is by thought. And that's something that's hard for us to get our minds around, because
it certainly is, and I tell you, I just can't. It's like, because I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't talk. I guess I'll just have to sit around and look pretty
they get
and
used
get my
to
get my halo spinning around real fast.
Yes. But they do get used
sort of
to it.
Parlor trick.
Here's a little story about, you know who Leslie Flint is, right? He was an extraordinary direct voice medium in the middle of the 20th century. And one of the people he brought through is one of the greatest wordsmiths we've ever known, Thomas Jefferson. And the first Jefferson said was that he didn't want to have to communicate with words, and none of them says exactly what you want. It was flabbergasting to me to listen to that recording.
So there is that limit, and the work that Lisa has, you know, that you talked to her about, is very important, because right there in that transition period between this life and the next life, there is this period where people can't quite put it into words.
Yes.
Now, if anybody listening here is old enough to remember reading comic books as a kid, or the rest of you've probably watched a lot of cartoons as a kid, we lovers of animated art all know that to get from one dimension to another, what do you have to do? You have to say something like Alakazamba or Zawamba Chanabu, right? It's in all the cartoons, right? The zap, the magic words or that take you to another dimension. And so that's what's happening with people and their dying process, is they're trying to put into words things that they can't really put into words, experiences they're having. And so by charting this area, which is so unexplored, all of this is just very important, and it gears to what I am saying because I'm completely confident there is a kind of rational breakthrough in the genuine, and I will underline genuine, rational investigation of the question of life after death. And
It's not a question. You and I know it's not a question. Now we're just filling in the details about it. There's no doubt that our minds are eternal.
Still is a question, too, because although I have to, in one way, say I give up and I don't know what else to say, especially when the doctors start telling me, I empathically co-participated in the patient near-death experience. Sure, I did. And, after you hear a few of those, and that you would trust completely these doctors, I give up. And so, but what brings me along in it is that we have entirely new ways to understand this language that they're talking. And that is opening up entire. We are now able actually to reformat people's minds with new principles of thinking so that when they do happen subsequently just by chance, like anyone else that happened to have a near-death experience, they will be able to articulate it for the rest of us in an entirely new way. And this has already been done, actually. It's worked once already. I've been working on it for decades. There's already been one case in which this worked. But it will work again, because this is on the horizon here, and studying the words of the dying, like the Final Words Project does, and in and investigating near-death experiences by in effect, rearranging your logical mind. Basically what we do is, what we can do now is to teach people some new principles of thinking. And this process of doing that just opens up parts of your mind that you didn't know you had, like cognitive abilities people don't know they have.
That's one of the effects of near-death experiences that's often reported. And it's interesting. The main thing to me that near-death experiences consistently prove is that our minds easily not only exist without our bodies, but they actually expand. In case people have not researched in the NDEs, let's talk about them a little bit. People who have been blind or deaf in life could see and hear during a near-death experience. In fact, that's kind of overwhelming. People born without eyes can see during a near-death experience. And they have mind sight, which is actually almost 360 degrees. Now, one of these should be, that's well documented, now there are many, should be more than enough to convince people your mind can exist easily outside your body. People can see things at a distance, and then it can be verified. People had that conversation, or this or that did happen. I can't remember her name, but there was the woman who had her entire body drained, and it was impossible for her. She flatlined. During that whole time, she watched the operation, and then she told them afterwards what had happened. One of those, Dr. Moody, is enough to prove your mind exists easily away from your brain, and that means everything else is true.
Well, I'm on a slightly different orbit on this one, Roberta, because I come from a different way of looking at it. I love science, and astronomy especially is since the age of 7. I follow closely, and I love physics, and I just really love science. And chemistry also especially I loved. And the history of chemistry, all of this stuff is just terrific to me. And at the same time, long before, thanks largely to Galileo and then Newton and a few other, and Robert Boyle, the chemist, the first chemist who lived at the time of Newton, that thanks to these people, we have this wonderful, wonderful methodology. And at the same time, before then, by about maybe 2,000 years or so, was Greek philosophy, and philosophy has been around for a much longer time. And these big questions, especially the question of life after death, it is not yet a scientific question. It's still a philosophical question.
No, it's a scientific question. Back in 1931, Max Planck, who got the 1918 Nobel Prize as the father of quantum mechanics, said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything we talk about, everything we regard as existing, postulates consciousness.
And I'm exactly on board.
I have said that to
him. Can I read a quote from Carl Sagan that I encountered today?
Okay, great.
We are a way for the universe to know itself. Some part of our being knows this is where we came from. We long to return. And we can because the cosmos is also within us. We are made of star stuff.
Yes, and see, where I come in on this is that I haven't reached made up my mind yet about whether there is physical reality or not. And I've been that way all my life, see. To me, even when I was a kid, I realized that consciousness was primary. And to me, the whole construction of the supposed external physical world is undetermined. I mean, to me, it's completely conceivable that all I know directly is my consciousness, and I infer an external world from patterns in my consciousness. And patterns in my consciousness could be generated by all kinds of other things I can imagine. And have always been able to imagine that. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't love physics, and I really follow closely all the developments. And, of course, the reality is that leads, too, to this state of incomprehension, because you get quickly into literally unintelligible things.
That's right. That's part of their problem.
See, and that's exciting. And the reason I'm saying that it's not yet a scientific question, what I mean is that there's a much more direct, that the concepts are what is the problem. And so that's where I am, is that there are whole new ways of looking at the concepts we're dealing with that lead to whole new ways of investigating it, one of which would be tracking the language. Now, everybody assumes, okay, who's in tune with this, that as people are dying, they go from one state of existence to some other state of existence, right? And so, since they are talking in this interim, that it's in that dying process, they're still uttering things. It's not too plausible to think that we can actually track that process of the mind going from this realm to the other, say, transcendent realm. With the difficulties that you must have experienced, too, in putting your experience into words, right? Like, mystics have to say, for example, they have to use oxymorons, like the dazzling darkness or the... Mm-hmm. And so it's just a normal thing. And it's like people with synesthesia, for example. And what synesthesia is, it's a neurological condition where the senses get mixed up, okay? And so there's a lot of different variants of it, but the most common variety is people who will tell you that when they hear music, in addition to hear the music, it's also accompanied by a sort of color show, like colors in there. Or there was a case that was noted a few years ago of a famous chef, or a chef who tasted shapes, who would, in his cooking, would have to, as he would cook, would be thinking things like, this chicken tastes, sort of pyramidal today, or it's you know, it's kind of tasting like a funnel, or that, you know, things that to the rest of us wouldn't make a bit of sense, but he is trying to put into words real experiences he is having, and the people with near-death experiences or mystical visions like you had are having that same difficulty. But now there's ways to help them with this. We really can fix this. And to do it, we're going to do it live on www.universityofheaven.com. Really, we will. And for that reason, Robert, I want to thank you so much for helping us with this.
Well, I'm happy to help. I saw that there was a little video on your website, you and Dr. Morse. Melvin Morse, in my recollection, was the one who pioneered children's near-death experiences, right?
I mean, That's right.
These are the two epic pioneers in this field, and they were trying to talk about what happens after death. Because what happens right after death and in the short period thereafter has been my 50 years of study, I wanted to raise my hand and say, I could answer. But, you know, wisely, you didn't try to come up with ideas. I have talked with people who had one NDE, and they were sure they knew everything about everything. And, and I respected very much the fact that you said, you know, I don't want to be Melvin. He was the one who said, you said, I don't want to be Raymond Moody forever. And therefore, I hope there's reincarnation. And indeed, there is. There's abundant evidence of that. But he said that we just sort of merge back into source. So we do, but there's sort of an eon in between, and I wanted to talk about that, but unfortunately I couldn't because you were on a video.
Well, I got to say, though, see, I'm on the other end of the spectrum from that. The people who came back from the NDE thinking that, sure, they knew everything. I have been quite sure from the time I was literally 7 or 8 years old that I will never know much of anything. I am reconciled.
If you're curious, that's good. Yes, that's the way we all should be. It's skeptical.
And it's the most fun. It's the most fun. It is.
Matter of fact, Raymond, who coined the term near-death experience, I've known him, I guess, over 6 years now. But he is only in the time that I've known him that he has felt comfortable saying, okay, I think I may actually now be willing to say that, you know, conclude that consciousness survives, because he has kept his mind open throughout his career. Because we really don't know. I mean, there's so much we really don't know, and it's wonderful not to know, because it's from that position of not knowing that we get to learn so much more.
But the problem is, though, that the scientists really will not look at this. There is plenty of information.
It's changing, Roberta.
It's changing a little bit, Roberta.
A little bit. It's like baby steps.
But that's okay.
For Max Planck, he said in his lifetime, he was so sad that his biggest discovery, literally the biggest discovery of the 20th century, was the fact that consciousness has to be pre-existing and continuously existing. And they ignored that. They thought, they gave him a Nobel. He was happy with that, but they ignored that. And he thought, well, science advances by deaths. But how many generations have we had since he died in the early part of the 20th century, for heaven's sake? You know, this is sad. I'm sorry. I get frustrated by it. And I love your large spirit that says, well, I still love science, and I still think it's going to work, and they'll be able to figure it out. I bless you for that. I'm just a little more skeptical of them at this point.
Well, no, I am. I don't think, like I said, I don't think it is scientifically determinable, but I think that's all right, because that's always the process has been, that it goes through a conceptual phase first, and then it's scientific, and that's where I see it happening. But in the meantime, like Lisa said, I give up. For example, one of the wonderful physicians we're going to interview on our forthcoming webinar series is, we're going to interview him with the patient whose life he saved. And this is just the most phenomenal. It's basically a wonderful young graphic artist was in a horrific car crash, and his wife was instantly killed, and as I remember, one of his children killed. And he himself had a leg. He lost his leg and came very near to death and had a profound near-death experience. But reluctant, as most, if not many, if not most patients are, reluctant to share this with their physicians for obvious reasons. And back in the 60s and 70s, when I was first interviewing people who had this, many of them remarked that they had tried to tell their doctor about it, or doctor about it, and had been rebuffed, or even had tried to tell their ministers about it, had been rebuffed. So people are justifiably a little, you know, reluctant, but he did describe this experience to the trauma surgeon who saved his life, and the trauma surgeon, to make a long story short, became very solemn and acknowledged that during the procedure, he sort of knew that, I guess, that the artist wasn't going to die, because during the procedure he had a conversation with the patient's wife who had been killed in the accident. And as I gather, as this doctor opened up about it, so did the nurse who was in the procedure acknowledge that although she did not see the wife, that she did, I believe, hear her. So, I mean, I give up. You know, I mean, but I haven't integrated this yet, because there's a lot of things to figure before we can put this into some generally acknowledged form that will make it stand up against every objection, because that's the only fun way to do it. You know something? I'm just sorry to say this, Roberta, because it sounds almost crass, but I have never had any noble purpose from my work. I am delighted and honored and eternally grateful that so many people have written to me and said to me, you know, that my work changed their lives and comforted them in grief, and that, you know, helped them understand their own experience or understand that other people had it too, and so on. And all those things are just wonderful. And at the same time, I say that the reason I wrote it was that I just thought, I'm so curious about this. You know, I didn't have any noble purpose. I just thought, wow. And not only was it wow, it was also wow since the time of Plato. And how in the world had the modern world missed this? But of course, I realized immediately was I knew immediately that the situation I was in consisted of a number of vectors. Number one was the happy lack of religious indoctrination that I had experienced in my life, and actually grew up with an attitude of not exactly hostility, more like incomprehension and like, what is this all about toward religion? And kind of condescending, you know, that these people are deluding themselves and whatever. And then the idea of an afterlife was double that. But see, my wake-up call was reading Plato's Republic. And Plato, by the way, is still one of my heroes. I mean, this is one amazing guy. And so then Dr. Ritchie, like I said. So I was doing this because it was such a fascinating subject to me personally. I wrote that. I would have written that book. I mean, I was writing all that but not with any intention of publishing it, actually. I write down everything. I've got notebooks and notebooks and notebooks, but I didn't have the intention of, you know, doing anything good, but I'm so glad it happened that way. But I was just, to me, what is the most fun is finding out what is. And the best way to do that is to be rigorous in your reasoning process. Because if you just sort of, put some flimsy argument together with something you want to believe anyway or already believe or whatever, and just really playing around with it, what's the point of that? Because of self-deception, we know we're doing it, right? So we're always uncomfortable. But if you subject it to a really rigorous, rational process, and I know how to do that because I was trained in analytic philosophy and logic was what I brought to this. And so for that reason, it stood up. And but to say that, I mean, you know, there's a lot of false claims made about this. But the reason that's bad is because the honest-to-goodness, rigorous claims are just astonishing in themselves. They really are. I mean, you know, there's no it's like incredibly, you know, to try to exaggerate this, this stuff is sensational in itself. Any exaggeration just makes it ridiculous. I mean, the utter stark reality of it is truly mind-boggling.
Well, now we're approaching the end of our time together in about 10 minutes, and I just wonder, Lisa, can you tell me, what do you think about this university? What do you hope will come out of it?
Oh, I hope that we'll be able to give people, give people information, but also some sense of inspiration and comfort. And for me as a linguist, working through the Final Words Project, I have very tangible, concrete material that opens up doors that I had never imagined. You know, I'm that kind of person. I'm a really concrete, down-to-earth person, and I don't think I'm the only person like that, you know. And it's so exciting to see through very tangible tools and perspectives that there is something beyond this world. And for me, it's just been extremely comforting. And I was talking to Raymond about this I think last week, that I used to be really afraid of flying on airplanes. This is just a detail, but now, you know, I have no problems because I feel that sense of comfort, for example. So I think one thing is comfort, another thing is information. I think learning is the most exciting thing, and it sounds like, from what I've heard from people who've had near-death experiences, that learning is something that we take to the afterlife with us.
And, completely, we do.
That's what we hear from so many people. And then my other strong motivation and excitement about this project is Raymond Moody is getting older, and he has midwifed or mentors so many people, including myself. He is an extremely generous person, as well as being one of the most brilliant people I've met. And the University of Heaven is going to be an opportunity for all of his associates and protégés to come up. And for the first time, he'll be interviewing them, or not the first time, but usually he gets interviewed. He'll be interviewing people about the work that he so loves. And he blazed the trail, as you said at the top of the show. He open this door for all of us. So I'm really excited about having a platform for, there are so many people, you would not believe how many books and researchers that really owe, you know, that come from Raymond's inspiration, because he's such a kind person and he's so inspirational.
Thank you, Lisa. And I want to emphasize too, like Lisa did, that in saying that I didn't do this work to try to help people or for any noble purpose. Now that that has happened, I'm really grateful for it. And now, you know, and me too. Yeah, that's the, another function we can have here is to bring information that comforts people about grief and near-death experiences too. So, and my old age here, you see, I have mellowed, and I say, yeah, because really at 74, there's nothing else left to do.
Oh, that's, I'm sorry, I'm 72, yeah. And my life is just beginning.
Oh, wow.
I really feel my life has just begun. So, I'm sorry, sir, 74 ain't old at all. By the time I'm 74,
well,
I'll
I mean,
really be going strong.
It's enough to reach the point where all you care about is helping others, is what I meant.
Yes, that's truly
I'm finished
all
with
that,
myself. And
yes. Yeah, isn't that great? I mean, actually, that's a wonderful feeling when you start realizing.
Oh, my God, it is.
That's what it's all about.
Thing.
It's all about.
It's all about other people. Me specifically, my grown sons are on their own. Like my grandson's got his parents, and my two adopted kids, both adopted at birth, now 20 and 17, respectively.
Yeah.
I'm here. I know that that's why I'm here now. And so, you know, it's just, it's a really neat phase of life because you, I don't know, it's just, it's wonderful.
I love it. I love it. I feel as if I've never had more.
Oh.
Hello?
Oh, maybe her time was up.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
No, well, I'm still here.
Oh, good.
I don't know. We must have had a glitch, but that's fine. Our lives are just beginning, and what's wonderful about all the people doing this work in our different ways is that each of us is finding a slightly different way to reach people and to make people happy. And now we're coming to the end, so I just happened to do a little housekeeping, but thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We will do this again soon.
Oh, thank you,
Roberta.
Such a pleasure.
Everyone, thank you for listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes and our wonderful guests, Lisa Smart and Dr. Raymond Moody. I'm glad you could be with us today. Please never forget that you are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you really get what that means, believe me, it'll change everything in your life for the better. Next week, our guest is going to be our wonderful friend, Dr. R. Craig Moody. Our topic will be what is really the hardest part for everyone studying the greater reality to get our minds around. We'll be talking about the fact that there is no objective time, and there's no objective space either. And how that all fits with what we believe we feel and see around us is something he is expert at explaining. So we're going to have him here next week to do that, because understanding this is essential to really getting your mind around everything that's going on. Again, what again is the website of the University of Heaven?
It is www.theuniversityofheaven.com.
Great.
Thank you so much.
I've already signed up for one of your seminars, so I'm excited about what
great.
You're doing.
Thank you,
and
Robert.
We're going to have a
Thank
lot of
you.
Fun with this. Everyone, meanwhile, my nonfiction books, as you know, are Liberating Jesus, My Thomas, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, The Fun of Growing Forever, The Fun of Living Together, and we even have children's books. What the first one is The Fun of Meeting Jesus. All of the books that I have out also are available in audiobook. I hear from people who say, I was listening to this or that book and I have this question. Remember, I will answer your questions. It can be a week sometimes before I get to them, because there are days when I get so many, almost no other time is available for anything else, because I'm trying to help people to understand what's going on. But I always, always answer questions. Just send your email through the contact block on robertagrimes.com. And of course, as you know, we're on Seek Reality is everywhere. We're on webtalkradio.net. There's a Seek Reality app in the iTunes store, and you can get that for free and apparently download just about everything. I love those people that they did that. But then year earlier, episodes that you may have missed are being rebroadcast by our wonderful friends at Dream Vision 7 Radio. And if you ever wonder where Seek Reality can be heard right now, just go to robertagrimes.com and click on the radio tab. And while you're there, please read my blog. I'm now blogging weekly, and I'm having so much fun with that, I can't begin to tell you. So it's so good that you joined us today, and please join us again next week. Meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality, knowing that you, most of all, are a powerful eternal being, and you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.